rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, it's all right here in the polls. This is absolutely incredible. If you look at the February 28th through March 1st Fox poll, for example, the Republicans down 14 points against the Democrats nationwide, generic candidates. This is the key to the whole thing, my friends. Welcome back to our program. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes after the hour. This is incredible. You just go right on down the list. This explains the vote in the House about the ports deal. This just lays the whole thing bare. People are asking, why did 60 Republicans vote, or not 60 Republicans in total, it was a 60-2 vote or 62-2 vote. All but two members of the House Appropriations Committee voted to make it illegal for Dubai Ports World to own and control our ports. And it's just very blunt language, and they attached it. They smacked that thing right onto the appropriations bill that's going to pay for Bush's war in Iraq and for the rebuilding of Hurricane Katrina. Things that, you know, it's like saying, yeah, sure, Mr. President, we dare you to veto this. Why would the Republicans who controlled that committee even allow this to happen? Here's the answer. You find it over at pollingreport.com. If you go to pollingreport.com/2006.htm, it's right there. You can go right on down the list. It's a chronological list going back from the February 28th Fox poll, the February 28th CNN poll, Democracy Corps poll, GWU poll, CNN USA polls, Pew polls, ABC polls, Democracy Corps, Diego, CNN USA Today, Gallup polls. Going the Republicans minus Democratic. This is how much, if people are asked the question, in the next election, there's a series, actually, of questions that people are asked in different areas and different places, but they all, and the variations are things like, you know, will you vote Democratic or Republican? Would you vote for a Democrat or a Republican right now? Do you think that the Democrats or the Republicans would do a better job running the House of Representatives or the United States Senate? These kinds of questions. And they boil these things down, and the shift is extraordinary. You're looking at, this is the Republican minus Democrat. In other words, the lead of the Democrats over the Republicans on February 28th, 14-point lead, 14%. On February 23rd, the Democracy Corps poll, or the Diego Hotline poll, 15%. On February 1st, 16%, the Pew poll. You go down to the ABC poll back in December 15th, 10%. The Hotline poll on December 12th, 8%. No, that was 10%. The Time Magazine's poll back in November. Now, we're back now 3 months. Back in November of November 29th, the end of November, 12% difference. You go back to the Newsweek poll, the 1st of December, or of November, rather, November 10th. November 5th through the 10th. Newsweek poll, 17 points. That the Democrats are favored over Republicans. Do you think that who's going to run the country better? Who are you going to vote for? What's up? And when you see Republicans moving like a flock of fish or a flock of birds or a school of fish, when you see them all turning at once, suddenly, like we saw this week in the House of Representatives, you know that something's coming down from Karl Rove. This White House does not do things by accident. I would submit to you that the one mistake that the White House has made in the last few years, political mistake, and you can say, oh, the war in Iraq was a terrible mistake. It wasn't a political mistake. That ginning up that war in Iraq in 2002 enabled the Republicans to take back the Senate. This is, you know, setting aside the whole issues of rigged voting machines and stolen elections and whatnot. Just set that aside for a moment. There still is the reality that there are swings in the electorate going on. The ginning up for the war in 2002, the October, November 2002, all of the resolutions and the war powers, and yes, Mr. President, you can go after him, all that kind of stuff, that gave the Republicans back the Senate in 2002. And the war itself, being perceived by Americans as part of a so-called war on terror, many believe gave the Republicans the presidency, held the House, and held the Senate in 2004. So, no, the war was not a political mistake. From you know, if you look at the careful political calculus that these guys are doing. So going back and asking, you know, what are the mistakes this administration's made? The only one that I can think of is the Harriet Myers nomination. Maybe I'm missing something, but that's the only one that's a real obvious one to me. And that one happened when Karl Rove was, everybody was talking about Karl Rove's going to be indicted. And he was dancing as fast as Fred Astaire there, trying to get out of that thing, trying to swing this way and that, and basically throwing Scooter Libby under the train. And I think Rove was just, you know, he said, Bush said, hey, you know, I got a Supreme Court nominee. I got an opening. My old friend Harriet Myers, I've she's been loyal to me for 30 years. I'd like to help her out. The Bush family rewards those who are with them. And so, it's okay with Gonzalez. And Rove says, okay, that's fine. I'm busy. And, you know, it was bad political calculus. But I think that Karl Rove was distracted. But he's not distracted right now. And the reason why is because he has felt the hot breath of Bubba, his potential, roommate, his potential roommate in a jail cell breathing down his neck. I mean, Karl Rove has actually had to have imagined himself going to jail. He's seen people around him going to jail. There's Jack Abramoff going to, in all probability, going to jail. You've got Duke Cunningham going to jail. I mean, Karl Rove is looking around going, whoa, this is serious stuff. And he knows the only way that he can avoid going to jail in 2007, and in all probability, George W. Bush being impeached, and probably Dick Cheney along with him, is if they can hang on to control of both the House and the Senate. Now, how do you hold on to control of the House and the Senate? How does your party hold on to control of both those two bodies in an election year with the entire House of Representatives up for election and one-third of the Senate up for re-election? How do you hold on to control of that if the majority of people in the United States, 14% majority, 15% majority, 16% majority, 10% majority, 12% majorities, if the majority of the electorate, the voting people of the United States, 17% majority, if the majority of the people in the polls are saying they don't like the party? And they don't like it, by and large, because of the behavior of the president, because they're really not paying that much attention to the individual members of Congress. Most people, the vast majority of American voters, if you ask them to even tell you one thing that their representative in the House of Representatives had voted on and what that vote was, yes or no, one major piece of legislation in the last year, they probably couldn't tell you. Most people don't know how their senators are voting. All they know is the party. And because the majority of the electorates, I've seen different numbers at different times, some as high as 70, 80, 90%, some down, you know, around 40, 50%, but still a majority, in all probability, certainly a majority of the electorate really only pays attention to politics in the 2 or 3 weeks before an election, maybe the month or two before an election if it's a presidential election. And so they're really just thinking party. So how does a party, which is perceived as being the president, redefine itself as being not the president? They take on the president. Very simple. So the Republicans in the House of Representatives stand up and say, we are not George Bush. George Bush is in favor of the port deal. We're opposed to the port deal. We're going to defy him. They're playing good cop, bad cop, with the American people being the victims. And the bad cop is George W. Bush, and George is saying to the members of the Republican members of the House of Representatives, all of whom are up for re-election, and to the Republican senators, he's saying, you guys be the bad cops, that's fine with us. We won't punish you this time. You know, normally they punish them seriously. We won't punish you, and we'll be the good cops. We'll be the bad cops. We'll veto the legislation. We'll stand firm. And that way, he allows the Republicans in Congress to create a gap, a chasm, a cleavage between the perception of Republican in the House or Senate and the Republican in the White House. So the House and Senate members can go home to their districts in come October, November, and say, I tried to stop that son of a gun Bush. I tried to stop him with that port deal, but, you know, he vetoed it and he overrode it. Or I was successful in stopping him. Doesn't matter. They win either way. This is all about politics. This is all about holding control of the House and the Senate. And what proves it to me is that this vote, which happened yesterday, happened this rider to this appropriations bill, this thing got slapped on immediately after Chuck Schumer, the Democrat from New York in the Senate, said he was going to do something like that in the Senate. And as soon as he said that he was going to do something like that in the Senate, the Republicans in the House said, oh, no, you're not going to be first on this. We're going to be first on this. This is going to be a Republican deal. And thus they got all the talking heads on all the TV shows and all the talk radio shows going, oh, isn't this amazing? The Republicans are taking on the president. The Republicans are not the president. The Republicans are not Bush. The Republicans are different than Bush. Oh, gee, maybe we should vote for the Republicans. 866 440-8466, our number, 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
When you're so down-hearted and misunderstood, over and over and over you go.
As you, my friends. Welcome back. Your light at the end of the tunnel, talk radio. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. And we've got to hang on tight to our dreams. The dreams that have animated this country for over 230 years. The dream of democracy in a constitutionally limited democratic republic right here in the United States of America. The GOP edges away from proposed cuts. By the way, our phone number, 503, it's 866. It's 440-8466. 866-440-THOM. And our website, if you want to drop into our live chat room, go to tomhartman.com. However you spell it, we'll get you there. Click live chat. Drop in and say hi. We see the USA Today today. With many Republicans nervous about cutting popular programs in an election year, lawmakers in the House and Senate are signaling they won't support President Bush's newest proposals for politically painful cuts in Medicare and other government benefits. Yeah, see, he rolls out this budget with $36 billion in cuts for Medicare. This is the program for elderly and disabled, America's most vulnerable. Yeah, cut them $36 billion. But let's give half a trillion or so in tax cuts to the wealthy, because after all, don't you know, if you give $550,000 to a wealthy person, they might create a $10,000 a year job.
With a robust package of at least $550 billion and across-the-board tax relief, we will help create more than 1 million new jobs.
Yeah, and if you believe that, you believe...
And when we talk about war, we're really talking about peace.
Yeah, right. Up is down, left is right. So anyhow, the Republicans are freaked out about this. They're just absolutely freaked out about it. And an election is coming. Every other year, Republicans start talking like Democrats, because the fact of the matter is the vast majority of Americans are where the Democratic Party has traditionally been. Tragically, there's a lot of Democrats who haven't figured that out. But that's where the party has traditionally been, is in favor of national health care. Harry Truman tried to roll out national health care in 1947. It was the first good national proposal for this. And he had the support of the majority of the Americans. The Republicans shot it down. They've been in a holding pattern ever since. The only way that they stopped Hillary Clinton when she and Bill tried to put forward what was frankly a very, very modest national health care proposal that would have kept intact health insurance companies, which I think should be simply zeroed out. You know, there should be no reason for us to have health insurance companies in the United States. But it would have kept it intact and all that kind of thing. It was essentially a Republican national health care program. It was by scaring people, by running millions of dollars worth of ads, deceptive ads, saying, oh, you don't want a government bureaucrat deciding what doctor you can go to, can you? Well, do you? And everybody said, no, I don't want some bureaucrat deciding what doctor I can go to. I tell you right now, if I want to go to a doctor, I've got to call up my health insurance company and say, who's the approved doctor in the area? Welcome to, you know, the world of George Orwell is the world of the Bushies. We've got to remind people about who the Republicans are, what they're all about, and the conservative Democrats among us as well. You know, the Joe Liebermans of the world out there. What they're all about, what they are all about fundamentally is this philosophy that says that government, which is to say a democracy, an American democracy, is a bad thing. This is their fundamental perception. The will of we the people, if we the people, through our elected representatives, if we tell our elected representatives, hey, we would like to have a national health care program, and we are willing to tax ourselves to pay for it, because it'll be more efficient than having to pay these private, for-profit health insurance companies. And we'll be able to save money, and we'll be able to stay healthy, and we won't have to worry about all this. No. Say the Republicans and the conservative Democrats. This is the conservatives. No, you can't have that.
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
Right. And then, of course, you have Tom DeLay. This is from the Tom DeLay movie, TomDeLayMovie.com.
By the time we finish this poker game, there may not be a federal government left, which would suit me just fine.
Now, good old Tom DeLay.
I would like to eliminate the Department of Education, the Department of Energy, HUD, the National Endowment for the Arts. We ought to zero them out. The National Endowment for the Humanities. We ought to zero them out. We're going to completely redesign our government.
I like him. And plus, when he's over there, we get our votes to the House.
Yeah, so you just have to understand, this is the fundamental conservative worldview, is that democracy is not a good thing in the mind of the conservatives. Instead, they want a conservative elite, a wealthy elite. And when I'm talking wealthy, I'm not talking somebody who's got a net worth of $1 million or even $5 million. We're talking, that's not wealthy. We're talking multimillionaires, hundred millionaires, and billionaires, a small elite, the 1/10 or 1/100th of 1% of America, who essentially owns the majority of the wealth in this country. They want that elite to rule, essentially. And we saw this during the Harding, Coolidge, Hoover administrations leading up to the Great Depression, when there was a whole massive series of tax cuts for the wealthy on the one hand. Herbert Hoover passed 6 of them, a series of massive tax cuts, and they were cutting away the protections that protected labor, working people in this country, at the same, and boom, it brought about the Great Depression. And I would suggest to you that we are now in a negative GDP state. It's just that they're jiggering the numbers. It's happening all over again. We'll be back with your phone calls after this. It's 27 minutes after the hour. I'm Tom Hartman, the place where reason is our lifestyle choice.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Horace Greeley said, go west, young man, so that's what we did do. We wiped out all the buffalo and the Indians with you. But we gave them bits of property that they could call their own. They said, thank you, Mr. White Man, welcome to our home. Ah, let's go to the ball game and sing our song with glee, and conveniently forget our past in the land of liberty and honesty, integrity, and bravery.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting. This is incredible. Over at thinkprogress.org, they have a transcript of an interview over on Faux News with Alberto Gonzalez. Now, here's the guy who's been involved in the domestic spying program, violations by the FBI and Department of Justice lawyers, the Patriot Act, breaking laws in the United States, torture resolutions, and this is the serious discussion that Fox News has with Ed Hill. Okay, and finally, we're talking about the state pies. I don't believe Texas has one. Florida's changing from key lime to pecan pie. Steve Ducey, yes, it's a big debate. Hill, now, shouldn't Texas lay claim to the pecan pie? Gonzalez, oh, I'll tell you, I've eaten some great both key lime and pecan pie in Texas. Ducey, can I ask you a personal question? Are you, sir, a pie a la mode man? Do you prefer ice cream? And it goes on like this. It just goes on and on and on. And, I mean, this is the official faux news way. Basically, it's their way of, you know.
I know nothing, I see nothing, and I say nothing.
Yes, the faux news. They should hire Sergeant Schultz. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And, of course, if you want to defend this administration or try to put forward some conservative talking points, you go to the front of the line. Unfortunately, nobody has called who is willing to do so. So we'll start with BJ in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, BJ, how you doing today?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Great.
I am right on with you about the whole Karl Rove and trying to make this thing politicize this porch deal. And what I think, I saw when Bush asked for the line item veto, this is my first point, he asked for the line item veto. The reason he wants that veto is because if they do push through the porch thing, it's going to be attached like they did. They put a rider on. He can veto it with a line item veto without vetoing the entire legislation.
Oh,
that's
bingo.
Part of their little deal right there. The other thing is, when I saw the Fox News poll, the reason they're doing that is they need to unify the corporate and the religious right right now. Right now, they're separate, and they need to unify that, and they need to kind of scare it into saying, hey, we're going to lose this thing, and we're going to lose everything that we've had going for the last 5 years with Bush. We need to get on the ball, and not only that, they need to get the money for it. And yeah. So I think right now they're running scared. They're going to try to pull those to those, but they can't get away from it.
Yeah, and also, BJ, the more they can talk about how they're the underdogs, the more they can cause an amnesia to happen among Americans about the fact that they are the ones who run every single branch of this government and are therefore responsible for the policies that have driven us off the edge of the road and into the ditch. BJ, good point. Thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. I appreciate it. Tony in Durant, Oklahoma. Hey, Tony. Oh, Tony just vanished. Let's go to Jim in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Jim.
Hi.
Hi.
You're my hero, man. You really are.
Thank you.
Folks say, you know, that we can't do this, we can't do that, we can't do the other thing. But there is something we can do. I've already done it. I've called both of my senators and my representative and said, yay, verily, let's impeach Cheney on the single count of the free speech zones of the 2004 election.
Mm-hmm.
That leaves us open to impeach him on any other thing in addition or the same thing again. And it has a set of side benefits.
Well, here's the problem, Dick, with the free speech zone, or Jim, rather, with the free speech zone things. It's really two problems. One, they've been upheld in court. And in fact, one of these cases, the Supreme Court just rejected. So for all practical purposes, they've been upheld all the way to the Supreme Court. So you'd have a hard time arguing that it's actually a crime, even though we all perceive it to be. And two, Bill Clinton actually had some of those things.
Well, once you see what you're expecting now from that, which I didn't know. Okay,
it was a shock to me when I found it out too. But this did not originate with George W. Bush.
Cool, that's fine. But how many voters remember that?
Yeah, well, see, I think that there are some very clear crimes that this guy has committed, telling the American people that there was a reason to invade Iraq. And that reason was very clear and very specific when he had decided, even before he was elected, that he was going to invade Iraq and that he was doing it for political purposes. Leading a nation to war for political purposes rather than for self-defense is, I believe, in the minds of most people, a high crime or misdemeanor.
Well, you're at Article 1, Section 8, and it's actually, in my view at least, it's treason. Because he raised his hand.
I will not disagree with you, Jim.
He raised his hand and he said, I promise to do my best to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution.
That's right. That's right. And he is not.
And he abrogated that over and over again.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Jim. And I appreciate the call and you make your point very well. Dick in Dayton, Ohio. Hey, Dick.
Hey, how you doing, buddy?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up, Dick?
Hey, I just wanted to tell your screener, everybody should get your book, What Would Jefferson Do? It tells the truth about the democracy of what we are. I've read it. I'm reading the first couple chapters. You're a great American, Tom.
Well, thank you, Dick. And thanks
to
my publisher, thanks you.
I want to say another thing.
Sure.
I keep the media here in Ohio going, and I write about, the legislatures, about this situation, and I get good results, and I'm going to start going to these meetings in Ohio.
Good on you. Good on you. That's what we need. That's what we need. Is we need to get people actively involved, out there actively involved. Dick, thank you so much for that.
Yeah, you're welcome. Bye-bye.
Great to hear from you now. And as I said, my publisher, which is Random House, which is owned by a German company, thanks you as well. Isn't that an irony? Joe in Grand Rapids. Hey, Joe.
Hey, I would just like to make a point that Betsy DeVos, the head of the Republican Party, said last year
in Michigan
that the middle class was making too much money. And now her husband's running for governor.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now I got to head back to work and try to get a piece of coal to heat my house.
Okay. Yeah, this is pretty amazing. Thanks a lot, Joe. Good to hear from you. The head of the Republican Party in Michigan said that the middle class is earning too much. And not amazing. Amy in San Diego, California. Hey, Amy, welcome to the program. Amy? Nope. No Amy there. Okay. Well, let's try Dana in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Dana.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
In regards to your earlier opening statements about the Dubai purchase of the port,
yes,
I'm kind of looking at it from a different angle. It seems that the proposed purchase of the port could be something as far as it's a proposal only from the standpoint of getting it into the media, getting a lot of emotions going, getting everybody to go, oh, we can't have this. We feel threatened. And since the Republicans, you know, their perceived strong point in getting reelected is national security. So, you know, this is kind of a conspiracy theory from the standpoint of if they set it up where the Republicans can now rise up against Bush, like earlier, creating that wedge, then all of a sudden their polls go up, and then it might just carry over into the November election.
Yeah, that was my point. My point was that Karl Rove, over the last month or so, has been looking for an issue where he can allow the Republicans in Congress to defy the president in a very public way and distance themselves from him so that when election time, in a very, very public way, so when election time comes, they can say, see, I didn't go with the president. I don't think that they expected it to be the ports deal. The ports deal got blown up, I think, in large part because Lou Dobbs blew it up on his, the Republican Lou Dobbs blew it up on his television program, and it caught on. It just caught the imagination of the people in the press. I think that they were preparing for it to be the NSA wiretapping thing. I think that they were getting all set for that to be the issue where the Republicans would go against the president. And in fact, the vote, 2-3 days ago in the Senate to not investigate it, to just table the whole thing and set it aside, all of a sudden tells me that they just moved their strategy from the NSA wiretap to the ports deal of coming up with, as you described it, a wedge item that they could use to wedge distance themselves, the Republicans of the House and the Senate, from the president so that they wouldn't get burned in 2006 in the elections.
Exactly. You know, this whole situation kind of reminds me of a movie that came out either in the late 80s or the early 90s called Wag the Dog.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a political satire movie.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
How they were trying to stage events that would get public sentiment going one direction so that they could come in and be the heroes to then, you know, say, look at us. We were able to take care of this situation.
Yeah. No, absolutely right, Dana, and very well said. Thank you for the call, and thank you for sharing that. John in Lorain, Ohio, we only have a minute left before we've got to take a break. John, what's up?
Hey, how you doing?
Great.
Hey, you know, this port deal is also a scam because what they're doing, too, is they're secretly breaking up the union down there. And that's not caught on with the public yet.
Do you have any specific information on that, John? Because I've speculated about that, but what I've heard is that Dubai Ports World, you know, the P&O, a British-owned company, has been working with the longshoremen, that Dubai Ports World would still have to honor the longshoremen's contracts, and that it's really not about that.
Well, I know a few relatives that I have that work out there,
mm-hmm.
and they're telling me that this is what they're doing is they're bringing in this company, they're doing their cheaper wages trying to bust up the union down there.
Yeah, well, they're always doing that. I mean, they're always looking for opportunities to bust up the union, so I'm not surprised. But
yeah,
I don't think that that's their first motive. I think that the first motive was basically they've got to sell off America because we've got this incredible trade deficit.
No, not to be funny, they already sold America off, and the American people ought to look through on the internet and follow the money trail, and they'll find out they sold it off a long time ago.
You're absolutely right, John.
Nothing new.
Yeah, this is an ongoing thing. This is a huge ongoing thing. It's 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman here on the True People's Radio.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Served on the Georgia road gang, couldn't pay the debts I owe. 'Cause I ain't made of silver, and I ain't ever seen no gold.
I still remember Rachel, soft as a velvet gown. They laid her in the pauper's grave on the other side of town.
So pass around the bottle, boy. Let's talk about
And welcome back to my friends. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. 440-8466, our telephone number. Terrence in Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening on WTKG. Hey, Terrence, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Sometimes it seems like there's a conspiracy across the media organizations, and what I mean by that, it seems like somebody is deciding that we're going to pump up an issue like the swift boats. We're all going to do it.
Right.
But on the other hand, yesterday they came out with the story that at the Moussaoui trial, the FBI did know that Al-Qaeda wanted to fly planes into buildings, contrary to what Condoleezza Rice says.
Oh, that was in
but
one of Bush's...
story's already been swept underneath.
Yeah, that was in one of Bush's presidential briefings. That came out like a year and a half ago, and that he had received over 50 presidential briefings, including one that mentioned flying airplanes into buildings, and that had happened back. And in fact, you know, when he went to Europe for the G7 or G8 meeting, whatever it was then, at that time, Italy? Whichever country he was in, they had to move him out to an aircraft carrier overnight because they had incredible intelligence that Al-Qaeda planned to hijack planes and fly them into the building where he was staying.
Now how come every media organization every time evidence comes up contrary to the 9/11 Commission report, they just sweep it under the rug?
Well, because there isn't... See, it's not so much that there is a conspiracy to not have things in the media, as much as there is a conspiracy or really an industry to have things out there in the media, Terrence. The way it works is that when there's a bad story about Democrats, if there's something, you know, for example, this thing right now with Hillary Clinton and Howard Dean, the supposed split between the two of them, she's going to build her own database and everything. I have gotten at least a dozen emails from various right-wing groups on this thing, because I'm a talk show host, I'm on everybody's list. They are pumping the media as hard as they can, and so the media responds to it. So there is this very powerful, energized strategy to keep things in the press, and the Democrats, frankly, are not as effective, not as efficient at that. They have only been doing it for a year or so, and doing it rather poorly. The Republicans have been doing it very effectively for the last 15 or 20 years, and it all started out with millions of dollars from Joe Coors and Richard Mellon Scaife, and, you know, it's well documented and no shortage of books out there. And there you go. I mean, that's the beginning and end of it, in my opinion. I may be wrong, but I don't think so. But I agree with you that is a big deal. By the way, that time that Bush had to go stay on the ship instead of in town because of the Al-Qaeda might fly an airplane into the building where he was staying was before 9/11. In addition to the presidential daily briefing that mentioned airplanes and as well as prominent buildings in New York and prominent buildings in Washington, D.C. Amy in San Diego, California. Hey, Amy, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. I have actually two questions, and one is really quick. I was just wondering if you've ever written any articles or you could direct me someplace for about illegal immigration. I know your stance is we should be putting the employers in jail, and I've said that to people. And they say, well, then, you know, it's going to cost $10 for an orange and all this baloney. Do you have some place where you've answered all those ridiculous arguments?
Well, you know, I've got an article on commondreams.org right now. And
you
do? Yeah. If you go to commondreams.org, it's
okay.
Right up at the top of the page. It's like the fourth or fifth one down.
Great.
About illegal immigration. It doesn't specifically answer the question about what's going to happen when oranges cost $5. But here's the answer to that question, very simply. Because the last argument that people in favor of illegal immigration have is, what about our farm workers? You know, what about the migrant workers?
Right.
And the bottom line is, if every industry in the United States was forced to pay a living wage, including the agricultural industry,
right,
yes, prices would go up, but wages would go up faster.
Right.
And so, you know, if an orange goes from costing, I don't have any idea what an orange costs right now.
Right.
I haven't bought one in a long time. You buy a bag of them or whatever. But let's say an orange right now costs 50 cents. If it goes to costing 55 cents or 60 cents or 70 cents,
yeah,
because of the added labor cost in it, my paycheck, you know, as an average working guy, my paycheck might go from $11 to $14.
Yeah,
because
we'll take care of it.
Yeah, because as the quantity of labor in the marketplace decreases, the price of labor goes up. It's just that simple. And right now, 10% of the workforce in the United States is illegal immigrants, and that has dramatically over the last 25 years, since it really began to explode under Reagan, that has dramatically driven down the cost of labor, which
right,
is profitable to corporations. One of the reasons why CEOs are pulling 500 times more than their lowest paid employee, whereas before Reagan it was 30 times more. It's in part because of that. And this is why the conservatives will never address the real issue, which is employment. They'll talk about fences. They'll talk about, you know, let's get all the races together down here with guns. Let's, you know, be the Minutemen. Let's all this stuff. But they'll never talk about the real issue.
Absolutely.
Amy, thanks a lot. I got to move along. I appreciate it.
One more question?
Sure.
Okay. It's the real reason I called was I wanted to see, I know George Bush said that he was going to veto any legislation that was going to get rid of the Dubai port deal.
Right.
And the UAE had said, well, if this deal does not go through, we're going to sue you through the WTO.
Right.
Well, is this a way for him to weasel around and actually get it to happen even though Congress has it in that bill?
Well, the fact of the matter is, my understanding of the World Trade Organization rules is that we can't say to them, no, you can't do this. Although there may be, you know, I'm not an attorney. I'm not an expert on the WTO. I've just, you know, written a chapter in a book about them. But my understanding is that they would have a strong claim in the WTO. And which gets back to my point of, you know, why do we have an international organization made up of other countries and multinational corporations making our laws for us? I mean, they're essentially making our laws for us. They're telling us what we can legally do and legally can't do. And because the Constitution says that a treaty, which is what GATT was in part, which created the WTO, a treaty supersedes state and federal laws. It supersedes everything except the Constitution itself. That why have we entered into this treaty? And why don't we do what Bush did with the anti-ballistic missile treaty and with the Kyoto Treaty and simply walk away from it? You just walk away from it. You don't have to worry about the Dubai port. But I guarantee you, Amy, that Bush has got a dozen ways in his back pocket to make sure that his friends in Dubai are well taken care of. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, I want to know what you're doing in your bedroom in Tennessee. Why am I not surprised? State Representative Eric Swofford, a Republican, and State Senator Charlotte Burks, a Democrat in name only, conservative Democrat, I've been thinking a lot for the last year about what's going on in people's bedrooms. They've decided that they're going to try to outlaw sex toys, shall we call it. I'm going to keep this a family program. Yeah, they're going to outlaw sex toys that resemble human anatomy. This is such a classic example of how the conservatives perceive morality as being about what people are doing in their bedrooms and in their private space, and they want to control it. The Republicans want to be in your bedroom. And Democrats and progressives and liberals have historically viewed morality as what are we all doing in public? What are there hungry among us? Are there homeless among us? Are there sick among us? Are there elderly among us who can't care for themselves? Are there young among us who need to be nurtured? If they're not being taken care of, then we can't lay claim to be a moral society. And the Republicans will have nothing to do with that discussion. Their idea of morality is, are they selling sex toys in stores? Well, we got to pass a law against that. Does somebody have one in their home? That's a crime. Back in Connecticut, it used to be illegal simply to have a birth control device in your home. Even if you were married. I mean, and this sex toy law that they want to pass in Tennessee will apply to married couples as well. Period. Harry Truman, back in 1952, just to make it so clear to you how not new this is, let me just share with you a little bit of a rant by Harry Truman about morality in government.
Now I want to say something very important to you about this issue of morality in government. It is just as immoral to use the lawmaking power of the government to enrich the few at the expense of the many as it is to steal money from the public treasury. That is stealing money from the public treasury. Legislation that favored the greed of monopoly and the trickery of Wall Street was a form of corruption that did the country four times as much harm as Teapot Dome ever did. Private selfish interests are always trying to corrupt the government in this way. Powerful financial groups are always trying to get favors for themselves. Now, the Democratic administration has been fighting against these efforts to corrupt the powers of government. We haven't always won, but we have never surrendered, and we never will.
When was the last time you heard a Democrat talking like that? I mean, we got to reincarnate Harry Truman.
All these years, we've been fighting to use our natural resources for the benefit of the public, to develop our forests and our public oil reserves and our water power for the benefit of all, to raise the incomes of all our citizens, to protect the farmer and the worker against the power of monopoly. And where have the Republicans been in this fight for morality in government? Do they come out and vote with us to keep the special interests from robbing the public? Not at all. Most of them are on the other side. The same thing when you come to the question of the conduct of government officials. The Republicans make a great whoop and holler about the honesty of federal employees, but they are usually the first to show up in a government office asking for special favors for private interests and in raising Cain if they don't get them.
There you go. Good old Harry Truman. It's amazing.
These Republican gentlemen can't have it both ways. They can't be for morality on Tuesday and Thursday and then be for special privileges for their clients on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday.
Yeah, but see, that's what they're doing right now. I'm telling you, that's what they're doing right now. And Harry Truman goes on to talk about how, you know, the Republicans would tell you that the world, the black is white, up is down. Is this starting to sound familiar? This is President Harry Truman, the Democrat, on March 29th, 1952.
Well, I don't think the black is white campaign of the Republican Party is going to succeed. I think the voters are going to see through this holier-than-thou disguise that our Republican friends are putting on. All the tricks of Republican propaganda cannot make the people forget that the Democratic Party has been working for their welfare.
And continues to.
We're working for the welfare of the farmer. We hold to the ideal that goes back to Jefferson, that a farmer should have the opportunity to own his farm, to share in the benefits of scientific progress, and to secure a fair income for his efforts. The Democratic Party is working for the success of our free enterprise system. We have worked to prevent monopoly, to give the small businessman a fair chance.
When was the last time you heard any politician say they were working to prevent monopoly, as now AT&T is buying back Bell South and reinventing itself as the monopoly that Jimmy Carter busted up? Any politician.
And to develop our natural resources for all the people and not just for the favored few. The Democratic Party is working for the welfare of labor. We have worked for good wages in our legislation, for unemployment compensation, and for fair labor relations laws. The Democratic Party is dedicated to the ideal that every family is entitled to fair opportunities for decent living conditions, to a chance to educate their children, to have good medical services, and reasonable provision for retirement.
Keep in mind, this is the guy who first proposed a national health care system.
That is why we have worked for good social security laws, for better education and health services, for good housing, and for equal rights and opportunities for all our people, regardless of color, religion, or national origin.
And this was 2 years before the Brown versus Board of Education decision that forced that. I mean, this is amazing. Harry Truman just speaking right out on these issues.
Above all, the Democratic Party is working for peace on earth and goodwill among men. We believe that war is not inevitable, that peace can be won, that free men of all lands can find a way to live together in the world as good neighbors.
There you go. Free men can find a way, yes. And the Senate now, morality in government, the Senate presented with a possibility of reforming itself. The Senate voted Wednesday to ban lobbyist-paid meals. Senator Trent Lott, Republican from Mississippi, this is from the USA Today, Jim Drinkard's column. Senator Trent Lott, Republican of Mississippi, expressed misgivings about the lobbyist meal ban. Now, notice they didn't ban lobbyists putting legislators on private jets and flying them around and wining and dining them in 12-star style with a lobbyist on board. No, that's no problem with that. Just a free meal, right? So Trent Lott says that he doesn't like this lobbyist meal ban, saying, and I quote, "It implies that we can be had for the price of a lunch or a dinner." Okay. Then he added, or he concluded, "I'll be eating with my wife, and so will a lot more senators." In other words, they have been being had for the price of a meal. Of course, the reality is that the meal is just the consummation. There's a whole lot of foreplay that goes on before that. There's a whole lot, you know, all kinds of stuff. Can you imagine how difficult it would be to call up a member of Congress and say, "Yeah, Senator Gordon Smith from Oregon, I'd like to take you out to lunch." Yeah, right. You think I'm going to buy his vote with lunch? No, but if I gave him $10,000-$20,000 as a campaign contribution, then he might want to go to lunch with me, listen to what I have to say. Not to pick on Gordon Smith. He is just right across the board. So here we have Jack Abramoff pleading guilty to tax fraud, tax evasion, and conspiracy. 59% of all Americans, according to the USA Today CNN Gallup poll, February 28th through March 1, 59% of Americans not at all confident that Congress can police itself. And this bill that is coming out of the Senate now, again, quoting USA Today, doesn't speak to a more common practice in which corporate and trade groups sponsor plant tours and conferences at luxury resorts with industry officials, leaves in place the progress by which lawmakers pay far less than the market value of the travel. This is the deal where they get to fly around, you know, in corporate jets in lavish style and just, you know, write it down as a contribution equivalent to the equivalent of first-class airfare. It's unclear whether the bill might even win final Senate approval. Trouble also looms for the legislation in the House. This is this incredibly watered-down piece of legislation. We need more policy. You know, as Harry Truman, one time, speaking of Harry Truman, a reporter came to Harry and said, "Harry, how come you're always giving them hell?" And he said, "I don't give them hell. I just tell them the truth, and they think it's hell." And that's what we have some politicians who are doing that. There are some very good Bernie Sanders, Peter DeFazio, Dennis Kucinich. There's Howard Dean. There are some excellent Feingold, Boxer. There are some brilliant politicians out there who are telling the truth, and the Republicans are just thinking it's hell. But we need more, and we will have more if you and I participate in the political process. If we start showing up and getting involved. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. And I wonder, yes, I wonder.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the place where smart people get their news. This is an interesting story. This is one of those ones that, on the one hand, seems like it might just be a fluff story. On the other hand, there may be a cut to it. There may be a blade underneath this thing that's going right after, for example, Roe v. Wade. The National Center for Men has prepared a lawsuit, nicknamed Roe v. Wade for Men, to be filed Thursday in U.S. Today in U.S. District Court in Michigan on behalf of a 25-year-old computer programmer ordered to pay child support for his ex-girlfriend's daughter. Here's the core of the argument, according to David Crary, a writer for the Associated Press. The gist of the argument: if a pregnant woman can choose among abortion, adoption, or raising a child, then a man involved in an unintended pregnancy should have the choice of declining the financial responsibilities of fatherhood. You get this? In other words, as long as women can choose to have an abortion, a man should be able to choose whether or not to pay child support. Mark Felt, director of the Men's Center, he says, "There's such a spectrum of choices that women have. It's her body, her pregnancy. She has the ultimate right to make decisions. I'm trying to find a way for a man also to have some say over decisions that affect his life profoundly." Now, you know, a lot of people think of the National Center for Men as kind of, you know, Deadbeat Dads Incorporated. I was going to say Deadbeat Dad Anonymous, except they're not anonymous. They're proud of it. And here's this guy who does, he's been ordered to pay $500 a month in child support to a little girl that was born from his ex-girlfriend. He's not contesting that he's the father of this child. He's just saying he doesn't want to pay for it. And he's claiming that she told him that she couldn't get pregnant. Well, you know, the simple solution is, you know, if he doesn't want to be paying child support, he can decide not to have sex. That's a very simple one. The other part of this is that we're talking about pre-birth and post-birth. I mean, if the opposite of this would be women saying that they should have an absolute right to simply walk away from children, to abandon children. And, you know, that's equally nuts. We'll get back to that in a minute. Ellen and Victoria, Ellen Ratner and Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service with us. Hey, Ellen.
Well, she's going to talk about Abu Ghraib, and I want to talk a little bit about this Dubai ports deal.
Okay.
And that is the White House says they're open to a compromise on it, but their veto is still a threat. Now, it's interesting. I had a conversation yesterday with a very prominent Republican who says that it's sort of good cop, bad cop. When the White House realized what a mess they were in, they thought that this was a way, this was a Karl Rove maneuver, that they could say, okay, you can, you know, look like you're beating up on the White House.
This is what I predicted to Victoria this morning. Did she tell you?
No, she didn't. See,
yeah,
she had no communication.
She called into our morning show, and she said, you know, this is what's going on. And I said, this is, they're playing good cop, bad cop. This is a Karl Rove strategy. Nothing comes out of this White House by accident.
But anyhow,
yeah.
I actually heard this from a major Republican yesterday.
Yeah, yeah. I believe it. I mean, it's just, you don't see when you see, you know, 60 Republicans in the House, or you know, however many it was, I guess including the Democrats, it was 60. When you see a whole mess of Republicans all moving like a flock of birds or a school of fish, you know that Karl Rove is in the back pulling the strings.
Exactly. And that's, you know, oh, no, we don't want this White House. But then they can say, you have Heather Wilson, who has a very tough race in New Mexico in the Albuquerque area, saying that she's a different kind of Republican,
right.
And it really allows them to do that.
Yep. Please don't throw me in that briar patch.
Why can't Democrats be that organized?
Well, because Democrats are not that sick and twisted, Ellen. I mean, this what you're talking about, what we're talking about here is really Machiavellian, and it does not serve the public interest. It does not serve the public dialogue or discourse, and Democrats are actually true to their principles, by and large, more or less.
By and large. I'm going to let Victoria talk to you about Abu Ghraib, and then I can come back, or we'll probably be out of time.
Yeah, well, okay. Thank you, Ellen.
Hey, Tom.
Hey, Victoria.
Well, Abu Ghraib is going to close.
Close?
They're closing Abu Ghraib, yes.
Really?
Yes, they're going to close Abu Ghraib.
Is this because they have built a prison? They've got this phony prison, or not phony, they've got this underground prison, secret prison running in Afghanistan right now, you know.
What they're going to do, they say, is they're going to be transferring prisoners to other facilities. But meantime, there's going to be Abu Ghraib New, which will be completed in about three months. And then Abu Ghraib itself will be returned to Iraqi authorities, and I guess the Abu Ghraib prisoners will be transferred to the new prison.
Interesting.
But,
so it is
symbolically important.
Yeah, but mostly just symbolically, don't you think?
Absolutely. I think symbolically it's important. I think if you're a prisoner of one of them, you probably don't really care what
now,
the place is called.
Now, a report that I heard this morning on public broadcasting said that they were interviewing a general over there, over in Iraq, and he said, they said, you know, what's going on in the cities? And he said, basically, we have redeployed out of all the cities. And I was like, whoa, this is like major news. And he just kind of said it in passing. We've redeployed out of all the major cities. In other words, there's no longer soldiers in the major cities. Are we beginning the rapid pullout so that the civil war can melt down and we don't get caught in the middle?
Well, that's not what you would gather if you were at the Senate Appropriations Committee hearing this morning, which I followed as closely as I could. Senator Durbin was asking about withdrawal, or at least some kind of withdrawal over the next year or so, and wasn't able to get any kind of a straight answer, certainly nothing like you just said,
yeah.
From either Rumsfeld, Pace, or Rice. It's not really her bailiwick, but it's certainly theirs.
Yeah. Well, we know that they intended to get out before the November elections, but, you know, plans sometimes go awry. Victoria, we got to run.
Right.
Thanks for the call. Victoria Jones, Ellen Ratner, TalkRadioNews.com, 27 minutes past the hour.
Thank you.
is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends. 25 and a half minutes before the hour. You're here in the Tom Hartman radio program for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. 1-866-440-8466. 440-THOMR. Telephone number, Darren in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Darren, welcome to the program.
Hi, hey, Bob. How are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up, Darren?
Well, there was a caller you had in your last hour that was talking about Betsy DeVos, who the former head of the Michigan Republican Party.
Right. I remember it was a year or two ago, wasn't it, when she made that comment about the middle class are being paid too much?
Yes, she sure did.
Yeah,
and her husband is currently running for governor of Michigan as a Republican.
Yeah, he's going to be running against Jennifer Granholm?
Yes, he is.
And it's a sure thing. There's not a primary he's got to go through or anything like that?
There might be a primary, but he's already running TV ads.
Interesting. Interesting.
In the state of Michigan.
So what's your take on this, Darren?
Huh?
What's your take on this? I grew up in Michigan, but I haven't lived there since 1978, so I'm a little out of touch.
Yeah, that I'm definitely aware of. Just so your listeners nationally know, Dick DeVos is the son of Richard DeVos, the guy that started Amway.
And he's got more money than whatever the cliche is, yeah, more money than God.
Exactly, and let me tell you about his wife too. His wife's maiden name is Prince, as in the Prince Corporation, which made automotive parts. They were bought up by Johnson Controls a few years ago, and now JCI is sending all those jobs to Mexico.
Interesting.
Yep. Interesting.
So you just wanted to inform us about this?
When I heard the other caller make the comment, I figured I need to call and talk to you and let you know exactly what's going on, because I've been letting everybody I know just refresh their memories that she said the words Michigan workers make too much money.
Right.
They're overpaid.
Well, Darren, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Yeah.
One more comment about his TV ad.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, he's. At the beginning of the ad, he talks about all the factories that have been shuttered in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
The first video clip that he shows is a factory that's long been closed in Grand Rapids for years, if not decades.
Mm-hmm.
So he's making it seem like this entire building is not being used at all. Well, there's about three or four shops that are set up in that building. So I feel that's a little misleading on his part. Actually, a lot misleading.
Sounds like it. Darren, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to us on WTKG there in Grand Rapids. Much appreciated. Jackie in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening on WPTT. Hey, Jackie, what's up?
You know, I just had this question going around in my mind, and thanks for taking my call, and of course, I love your show.
Thank you.
What happens ultimately? I mean, I know this seems like it's very short-sighted on the administration and all of our so-called elected officials. But what happens ultimately? I'm watching people around me losing their jobs, getting decreased salaries, you know, small businesses closing. What happens down the road? I mean, I just got an email today talking about the minimum wage, and the minimum wage is, you know, is disgraceful, and where the congressman gave themselves a raise of $3,100 last year. Ultimately, what happens? Who pays the salaries? Where does the money going to come from? I mean, what is the final result of what's going on?
Well, this is the end game that you're talking about. Initially, first of all, we had a country that for 230 years, by having an international trade system with tariffs, built up incredible wealth by saying, you know, if there's a dollar's worth of labor and a pair of tennis shoes made here and 10 cents worth of labor and those same pair of tennis shoes made in Malaysia, then when we import them into the United States, if you want to import them, you can do so, but there's a 90-cent tax. So we equalized the cost of labor all around the world and all our products, and that kept American industry in America. That, plus the incredible natural resources that we have in this country, turned us into the largest manufacturer of finished goods in the world. In 1980, when Reagan came into office, he was handed the wealthiest nation in the world. We were the largest creditor in the world. That is, more countries owed us money than any other country in the history of the world. We were we were, and we had the most solid, stable, and safe middle class, probably in the history of the world.
And I know all that because I listen to your show all the time, and I understand all that. But what happens? What does finally happen? Where is the money going to come from?
Well, the dismantling process, the way the dismantling process works is they start, first of all, they did this whole international free trade thing. So now we're buying more from the rest of the world than we're bringing in. So all of the good paying jobs are going away. So we're ending up with a service economy. We're going to end up ultimately, if we continue down this road, if we continue down this conservative / Republican road, And there are Democrats who are advocates of this as well. If we continue down this road, we are going to end up basically having an economy that is entirely dependent on us serving ourselves. That is, it'll be a service economy only. And it's unsustainable because we're continually buying things from other people, from other countries, because we no longer manufacture things. And therefore, we have to give away what we own. So, you know, I've used the metaphor before of, you know, the person who's living in a home and they're living beyond their means, and so finally the credit card company comes and says, you know, you owe us $50,000 on the credit card. And so the person says, well, you know, take my car and take my furniture. And so they do. And then somebody else comes along and says, well, you know, you owe us $20,000. And they say, fine, take my front yard. And somebody else comes along and say, take my backyard. And then they say, yeah, well, take my front door, you know. And that's our ports. And that's, we're halfway into that process right now,
right, so
of selling off America.
So eventually the UAE and China, et cetera, will be paying the congressmen's salaries and giving them the raises?
Well, they are right now.
Okay.
They are right now. But, I mean, they're not paying their salaries through the taxes, but the salaries are not the major compensation for these. I mean, Tom DeLay's not flying around the world first class on corporate jets with $150,000 a year salary as a congressman.
Right.
And so, yes, multinational corporations are paying for this right now. But the end game where you end up with this is basically the United States being a vassal state, being a third world country, where we export our natural resources. Our labor is essentially slave labor. We will be in the position, and we are run by an oligarchy. We're run by a small number of incredibly wealthy and powerful families and who want to keep the status quo like that. And they live in their gated communities, and they've got, you know, cheap labor, and now any millionaire can afford to have a maid and a butler and a valet, and that's, you know, from you and me, the middle class, what used to be the middle class, now the working poor, providing those services. And America is going to be being turned into something that very much would resemble Mexico maybe 20 years ago.
Thank you, and unfortunately, that's the same way I've seen it, and I've been confirmed. Thank you. Sorry to hear it, though.
Yeah, you're welcome, Jackie. Thank you for the call. And that's why we need to make the change, because the evisceration of the American middle class, the death and destruction of the American middle class, is very much what the Republican agenda is all about. And one of the major ways they do it, there's a series of very simple steps that they have taken. And it's not like we haven't been warned. One of the first steps that they took is this whole idea of globalization. They had Tom Friedman out there flogging this thing with this olive tree and the Lexus and his The World is Flat book. And of course he's becoming part of the ruling elite, right? He's becoming part of the pundit class. He's becoming one of the multimillionaires just like all the rest of them. And so you've got Tom Friedman out there with that stuff and very well rewarded for his efforts. And the pitchmen for this, Bill Clinton and George Herbert Walker Bush, both of them. Remember the debates with Ross Perot? Here's Ross Perot, a guy who literally has billions. I mean, he's in a situation where he's not fighting for his survival like the American middle class is. He's not in one of those situations where if it doesn't work out, he's going to end up destitute. He's going to be homeless. He's not going to know where his next meal is coming from. Ross Perot is doing very well, thank you very much. And still, he felt it was important to stand up and say, hey, wait a minute. If you travel down this road that Bush and Clinton are pushing for, of signing the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades that will create the World Trade Organization and signing the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, and now CAFTA we just had, which is the most recent iteration of this. You travel down this road, you're going to see this giant sucking sound. And he was pointing to the south, and for a while it was to the south. There was all these maquiladora factories being set up down in Mexico and along the border towns for a while. But then, you know, off it went to China. Let's give China most favored nation status. George W. Bush does that. And Walmart and all these other. And it's not just Walmart. And it's not even that Walmart is doing something wrong or any of these companies are doing something wrong. It is that the fundamental idea here is that it's an appropriate thing for us not to make things in the United States anymore. This is what these guys really believe. And so at first when it first started 25 years ago with Reagan, and really started picking up steam, and Reagan was, you know, asking for fast-track authority so that he could do on a country-by-country basis what we've done with GATT and NAFTA. Basically, you know, they call it level the playing field. It levels the playing field for multinational corporations. It screws labor. It means that there is, you know, it does away with what used to be a level playing field for labor. But now it's a level playing field for multinational corporations, and they're loving it, right? They're profiting incredibly off this. And if you go back to, you know, when this started, you could see it's not like we weren't being warned. So that's one piece of it, the change in our international trade policies. The second piece of it is the change in our immigration policies. And that is, we started, and under Reagan this began, started taking apart the unions, who were the first barrier to entry into the American workforce. Unions did not want illegal immigrants coming into the workforce. They still don't. The AFL-CIO is out there, you know, one of the more loud people or organizations out there speaking out against Bush administration trade policies, because they understand that if you flood the workplace with millions of extra workers, wherever they come from, then you're going to drive down the cost of labor. Driving down the cost of labor, cheap labor, it's good for CEOs, good for big corporations, not good for the rest of us. There are even those who argue, and I'm not sure that, you know, I could make this case, but there are even those who argue that one of the reasons why the big corporate folks are combining, are hooking up with the big anti-abortion folks, you know, like the guy from Domino's, is not just that they're Catholic or something like that, but because more people, more laborers, lower costs. Domino's gets cheaper labor. Hey, everybody wins, except for the American middle class. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. Tom Hartman here with you. In recent statements, the president, the vice president, and key congressional leaders have said that the increase in revenue in 2005, tax revenues in 2005, went up.
Well, you know, actually what you find is that any year that you don't have a really serious recession, tax revenues go up because inflation goes up, because the number of people living in the country goes up. Mostly it's inflation, but it's also, you know, the economy continues to grow slowly. I mean, it's just a fairly inevitable process, particularly when we have a system that internalizes profits and externalizes costs to everybody else. But in any case, they pointed out that the revenues, tax revenues in 2005 are up, and the president has said this on occasion, the vice president has said this on occasion, and a number of Republicans in Congress have said that this proves that Bush's tax cuts have paid for themselves. You get this? For example, on February 8th, he says, you cut taxes and the tax revenues increase. Dick Cheney, the tax cuts have translated into higher federal revenues. Bill Frist, when done right, tax cuts actually result in more money for government. Dick Cheney again. Evidence is it's time for everyone to admit that sensible tax cuts increase economic growth and add to the federal treasury, not to mention all the right-wing talk shows out there saying the same thing. So the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities decided to look at the numbers. Could it be? I mean, they went back and they looked at the projections. Bush, the administration was not hiding these numbers. They were pretty clear about it.
With a robust package of at least $550 billion and across-the-board tax relief, we will help create more than 1 million new jobs.
And they said billions of additional dollars in tax revenue. So when they looked at it, over the 3 years now, since the enactment of the 2003 tax cuts, that's the year 2003, the year 2004, and the year 2005, in total, we actually brought in $316 billion less less than the administration had forecast for these years before the tax cuts were adopted. In other words, they said, okay, if these tax cuts are going to raise the revenues, they actually lowered the revenues by $316 billion, which just makes sense. I mean, if you're bringing in less money in taxes, you're going to have less money. You know, Lafler's curve and all this stuff, the voodoo economics that Reagan bought into and that Bush has bought into and these guys are trying to sell to us. Yes, it is true that if you tax people at a 100% rate, if 100% of their income is being taxed, then, you know, they're going to have less incentive to work. And the only people who are going to work are going to be the people who love what they're doing, who would work whether they got paid or not. And oddly, there's probably a lot of people like that in the workforce. I would guess that maybe as much as 20-25% of the workforce falls into that category. People, you know, people find meaning in their work. A lot of people, I do. I know a lot of people do. And one of the problems that you see with people who retire, you know, what am I going to do? I'd like to go back to work. Well, you can't anymore. Oh, well, that's tough. So in any case, They said that this is going to actually increase money. It didn't. So yes, if you took 100% of the income in income taxes, people wouldn't work. On the other hand, if you took 0% of the income in taxes, if people got to keep everything they earned, you would have no money to pay for all the services that people want, no money to operate government, no money to pay for our roads and for our police and for our fire departments and for traffic lights in the schools and everything else, nothing. And so there has to be some point in the middle there where people will continue to work and they'll continue to pay taxes and you can have a government that works well. Now, Franklin Roosevelt started with, during the Great Depression, he kicked the tax on people who are making more than, in today's dollars, around $6 million a year, kicked that up to around 70%, and then as World War II came along, kicked it up to 90% for multimillionaires. And that's not net assets. This is annual income. And the average working person paid very little tax back then. And what we have seen over the years is that the tax burden has gradually been shifted from the very wealthy to the average working person year after year after year, but it's particularly speeded up since Reagan, and now under Bush, they've just kicked out the doors. So, you know, the findings in short form, during the current recovery, both revenues and economic growth have been weaker than in a typical post-World War II recovery, in large part because of Bush's tax cuts. Revenues over the economic recovery have fallen at an annual rate of 0.6% after adjusting for inflation and population growth, whereas typically you would find it would be 2.7%. So it's not working. The tax cuts are not working. The tax cuts, in fact, are harming the government and harming us. Revenues grew much more quickly in the 90s when taxes were raised than in the 1980s when taxes were cut. And you can go all the way back to the 30s and see the same thing. Based on the administration's own projections of revenue growth through the end of the decade, revenues in the current decade will grow at only one-fifth their rate of growth in the 1990s. And this they continue to try and peddle this Kool-Aid, and they continue to find people who are willing to drink it. And it's a tragedy for America because it is bankrupting this country. We are having to borrow $2 billion a day just to keep the government running. And then that money that the government is spending is, in part, one of the few things that's keeping the economy going. But it's borrowed money. It's our grandchildren's money and our great-grandchildren's money. And should we live long enough, our money that they're borrowing in our name from China. And then China says, we don't like how you're behaving around Taiwan. Now, maybe we won't loan you any money anymore. Then we got a problem. 3 minutes before the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. For a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, the assault is on Richard Pombo, the Republican from California, and Mr. How do you pronounce it? Crapo? The Republican from Idaho, the senator from the Republican senator are leading the charge against the Endangered Species Act. And as a consequence of this, yesterday, a leading group of 5,738 biologists signed a letter stating the concern over these two bills introduced to Congress that will, they say, dramatically change the Endangered Species Act that Pombo and Crapo, well, however you say it, are promoting. And we have with us Stuart Pym. He's the chairman of conservation biology at Duke University in Durham. He's the author of The World According to Pym, P-I-M-M, A Scientist Audits the Earth. Professor Pym, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me on it.
Glad to have you with us. What happens to this world when the endangered species are gone? Why does it matter?
Our world would be such a poorer place. I think probably every American should feel proud of what we've accomplished with the Endangered Species Act over the last 30 years. As an American citizen, obviously not originally, I grew up in England, but I've been an American citizen very proudly for many years, and I have an enormous sense of what, as a nation, we've accomplished. And it reaches everybody. We have bald eagles in every one of the lower 48 states. We have peregrine falcons nesting in New York, a major cities in the East Coast. Many people now go whale watching off our coasts to see gray whales in the Pacific and humpback whales in the Atlantic. We have accomplished so much, and in doing so, protected our environment and shown that we can be extraordinary stewards of the wildlife of our country.
So the Endangered Species Act has not only protected species, but it's actually brought some species back from the edge of extinction.
Yeah, there is absolutely no doubt. The technical process is a species is listed. What we mean by that is the federal government decides that a species is endangered, sort of endangered with a capital E. It has It has status. And once the species becomes listed, once it becomes recognized as being vulnerable, the chances of that species surviving are very, very good indeed. If species are not put into that category, then they have a much, much higher probability of going extinct.
Yeah,
so it's clearly an act that works.
According to the Convention on Biological Diversity, overall extinctions are coming at 100 to 1,000 times the normal background rate. Richard Leakey wrote a book called The Sixth Extinction, in which he suggested that we are right now full bore in the middle of the sixth historic extinction on this planet Earth. They concluded that a third of all amphibians, a fifth of mammals, and an eighth of all birds are now threatened with extinction.
Exactly so. Richard's metaphor is the sixth extinction. Those numbers of 100 to 1,000 times what they should be are numbers that come from the research that my group has done. We are looking at species disappearing at a very high rate. Species ought not to be going extinct at a rate that anybody would notice. There ought to be a 1 in a million chance that a species would go extinct every year.
Now we have conservatives out there like Pombo and Crapo who are saying, these Republicans who are saying, well, you know, so what? You've had extinctions in the past. There have been five historic extinctions. The dinosaurs went away, but hey, we replaced them. We're a better species. Maybe an extinction is a good thing. Who should care?
I have testified in front of Representative Pombo and Senator Crapo, that question does come up, and I think it has a pretty standard kind of an answer. It's one that politicians understand. It's like death, and it's like taxes. You know, we all have to pay tax, but we don't want that taxation rate to be too high. You know, we understand that death is a part of life, but we don't want to die too soon. And what's happening is that species are, you know, the extinction tax is much too high. Species are going extinct too quickly. They are dying before their time. You know, 1,000 times faster than they should. So while extinction has always been part of life on Earth, not extinctions at this current rate.
So why are these conservatives attacking the Endangered Species Act now And what is the rationale that they're using? I'm assuming that they're attacking it now because the Republicans control the House, the Senate, and the White House, and they figure they can get away with it. Although, you know, perhaps you can illuminate me as to some deeper, you know, time, you know, meaning to the time sequence. And what's their rationale? Why are they doing this? Is this purely in the interest of landowners and developers?
I think that's a complicated question. I'm a scientist and not a politician. I'd like to point out that when the endangered species was passed during the Nixon administration, it was passed with the overwhelming support of both sides of the aisle. And polls of our country show that, you know, the vast majority of us support environmental protections, that support the Endangered Species Act.
Oh, sure, but polls also show that 75% of Americans want national health care and have since 1947, and yet we haven't gotten it because you've got these powerful interests in Congress lobbying Congress on behalf of the health insurance industries and the pharmaceutical industries and the private hospital industries. And here we've got, you know, the developers industry. I'm trying to drag you into a political discussion that you don't want to go into, but it just seems like this really ultimately is a political issue. There's a political process.
I'm disappointed by by the actions of Mr. Pombo on this, because I think, you know, there is such a broad consensus on protecting our national heritage. It's certainly not something that one should think of as being a partisan issue, only because there's a lot of support for endangered species protection from the Republican side of the House. It's not a Democratic versus a Republican issue. Now, I should point out that the majority of endangered species are on private land, and all scientists who look at this understand that there is an issue that we have to take care of. We do not want private landowners to feel that this law is burdensome, and that's particularly the case.
Why not?
Well, it's particularly it's.
When we left Vermont, we owned 400 acres of land in Vermont. There were parts of that property that had wetlands on them that were protected by the state.
Sure.
I knew that. I couldn't do anything. I couldn't drain it, even if I wanted to. And that was fine with me. I respected that. What's wrong with saying, hey, we the people, we society, we're collectively going to say, even if you own it, you are still part of our society. Your life only lasts as long as your life. That land is going to be there for generations to come. You can't kill off the species on it.
I mean, that is my personal viewpoint, too. My land here in North Carolina backs up onto a lovely area of forest, and I can't put a hog farm onto that land. There is, I think, a really practical issue why we want to reach out to the private landowners, though. If you're a private landowner and you've got endangered species on your property, you are being a good steward of that land. If you're being a bad steward of your land and you have damaged that land, you've harmed it, you've cleared all the forest, then you're probably not going to have endangered species on it. So, in a sense, you know, it's not us versus them. We're in this together. And clearly, landowners who've cherished their land, have looked after it, have left wetlands, have left forest intact on their land. You know, these are people who, at some level, you know, share our sense of stewardship.
But there are developers who would like to. There are developers who would like to buy that land. Well, when I left Vermont, I mean, there were developers who would have loved to have bought the land if they could. And in fact, I could have gotten a lot more money for it if the swamps could have been drained, but they couldn't.
Exactly so, and that's where I think we have to look at this as an issue that restricts what we do. There are restrictions on the land I own, just. I said, I can't put a hog farm on my land because my neighbors would object. And
so we have less
of those kinds of constraints.
We have about a half a minute left. We're talking with Stuart Pym, the chair of conservation biology at Duke University and the author of The World According to Pym, A Scientist Audits the Earth. What should citizens be doing to stop the evisceration of the Endangered Species Act?
I think, the obvious thing, if you care about the environment, if you care about the species around you, let Congress know. Write to your senators, write to your representatives, and say we want to protect this act. It's worked. It's done a great job. Let's keep it that way.
Now, here's the confusion. This act, this law that is going to rip apart the Endangered Species Act, is called the Endangered Species Improvement Act. So if you call your member of Congress and you say, you know, help the Endangered Species Act, they'll say, cool, I'm going to sign the Improvement Act.
Yes, well, you know, George Orwell
is alive and well.
Is alive and well.
Yeah.
I mean, one should not judge an act by its title.
Right. So people have to, when they contact their member of Congress, make it very clear that they are opposed to anything that will water down or negatively affect, alter the Endangered Species Act. Specifically, they're opposed to anything that Crapo and Pombo are doing, I would say. Stuart Pym, thank you so much for being with us, sir.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much.
Great speaking with you. The World According to Pym, a scientist audits the Earth. Fascinating. We'll be back 16 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
It's good to be king, just for a while. To be there in velvet, yeah, to give them a smile. It's good to get high,
Bush.
To come down. It's good to be king,
Bush.
Of your own little town.
Yeah. King of Crawford. Welcome back, my friend. 21 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Our progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Don't tell Bill O'Reilly that. We'll be dragged off, right? I can just see it coming. You know, here we... Oh, geez.
So, all those clowns over at the liberal radio network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains? Because they, you know, they're undermining everything.
Well, speaking of undermining, the undermining is monoculture. Monoculture, and this is why the Endangered Species Act is so important, because it's like one thread in a larger fabric. The whole idea that nature should consist of rabbits and deer and nothing else, and that all these other species, we don't need all these other species. And, you know, our food supply should just be a few foods. I mean, here we have 1 in 3 Americans will get cancer in their lifetime. 1 in 3 right now. Could that have something to do with the fact that most indigenous people, and for most of the history, the 150, 160,000 year known history of the human race, typically indigenous people eat, over the course of their lifetime, well over 1,000 different foods, and over the course of a year, typically as many as 400 different foods, whereas Americans typically eat fewer than 40 foods on a regular basis. Think about it. I mean, just start counting the things that you eat. And look at the incredible diversity around you. How many micronutrients are you missing? How many little types of this substance, or little amounts of that protein, or a little bit of that mineral, or are you lacking as a result of this? One of the reasons that I think, you know, herbs are such great things, but that's a whole other thing. But in our food supply, Not only are we getting down to mono foods, but we're getting down to mono species within the foods. I mean, it used to be that there were dozens of varieties, hundreds of varieties of corn and wheat in the United States, hundreds of varieties of apples. Different. And now what? You know, everybody grows for what'll ship well, what'll last longest in the supermarkets, what has the highest yield, what is the most pesticide resistant? And now on top of this, we have companies like Monsanto succeeding in patenting life forms and then saying, well, this is the only one there is. This is the only one you can use. So we have our monocultures in our food. Not a good thing. We have monocultures, single cultures, now increasingly happening in nature. This is the wiping out of species by our incredible activity on Earth. I mean, you look at the spread of humankind across the Earth, and in many ways, you look at the pictures from outer space, and it looks like an infected organism. Monoculture in business. This is what the founders tried to prevent. This is what the Boston Tea Party was fought over. This is why in 1881, Senator Sherman from Ohio introduced Senate Bill No. 1, the Sherman Antitrust Act, was to prevent monocultures in business. And now we have this coming back with Walmart becoming the largest company in the world and wiping out literally entire communities of small retailers, small and medium-sized companies. And not just Walmart, of course. And everybody wants to get into that game, whether it's, you know, whatever it may be. There's a dozen big box names. The names, what's so weird, I have to tell you, and I am revealing my age in this, but for those of you who, and those of you who are younger listeners, you just have to use your imagination. What's so weird to me is that when I travel around this country, and I've done a lot of traveling around this country, and increasingly around the world, you see the same thing, but particularly around the United States, I travel from city to city, and back a decade ago, when I made a large part of my living traveling around doing training and giving speeches and book tours and whatnot, and I would be in a city, and I would have no idea what city I was in. I wake up in the morning, I had to look at the airplane ticket to see where I was, because if I looked at the name of the hotel, it was the same as the hotel I'd been in the same city before. If I looked out the window at the restaurants, if I looked out the window at the town, everything was the same. And I remember in the late 60s, hitchhiking across the United States, and every town was different. Every town had local stores. So monoculture in business. Monoculture in the press. Increasingly, we're seeing just a small handful, just a half a dozen companies or so, controlling as much as 80 or 90% of all of the media that Americans absorb throughout the course of a year. This is not healthy. It's not healthy for diversity in thinking. It's not healthy for a healthy and vibrant democracy. It's simply not healthy. So monoculture, whether it's in nature, whether it's in business, whether it's in the press, whether it's in our food supply, whether it's in reproduction, you see monoculture and reproduction, the royal families of Europe developing hemophilia because they're interbreeding, or inbreeding rather. I mean, it's just, you get it. Diversity is a good thing. Cultural diversity is a good thing. Language diversity is a good thing. Press diversity is a good thing. Business diversity is a good thing. Nature diversity is a good thing. And of course, species diversity, a good thing. Contact your member of Congress about this attempt to destroy this Endangered Species Act. 1-888-355-3588 for Congress. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
It's a really great day to size the nation. Who just get in the way because their people have too much of a say. But boys, we have got the answer. Free trade. It sounds really good. It spells freedom for the corporate brotherhood. And you need us. In your neighborhood with new global employers. Oh, honey, let's join the WTO. Make lots of money at the WTO.
Telling the truth that the multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know about. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Let's see, 25 minutes before the hour. The Dubai Port Company to divest itself of American holdings, writes Jonathan Weissman and Daniela Dean in the Washington Post. Posted just minutes ago, the United Arab Emirates company that was attempting to take over management operations at six U.S. ports announced today that it will divest itself of all American interests. The announcement appears to head off a major confrontation that was brewing between Congress and the Bush administration over the controversial deal. Senator John Warner, Republican of Virginia, announced on the Senate floor shortly after 2 p.m. that Dubai Ports World would, quote, fully transfer the operations of U.S. ports to a U.S. entity, end of quote. Warner, who has been trying to broker a compromise on the issue, said DP World would divest itself of U.S. interests in an orderly fashion so as not to suffer economic loss. It is not immediately clear how the divestiture would be handled or what U.S. companies would take over the operation. What do you want to bet Halliburton's in on this thing? Warner's announcement came just hours after Republican leaders from House and Senate met with President Bush to tell him Congress appeared ready to block the deal. Isn't this convenient? I'm telling you, this was the gift from God to the Republican Party. Or at least they turned it into it. I mean, it didn't start out that way. And they will find more. There will be other, between now and the end of the year, absent an attack on the United States, which would cause Americans to rally around and, you know, God forbid, cause Americans to rally around the president and his party, absent an attack on the United States, they are going to have to find further ways to distance themselves from this president. Because, for example, when he said...
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
He was lying through his teeth in the first half of that. In the second half, apparently, he was telling the truth. So here's, you know, it's, well, we'll see how it plays out. We'll see how it plays out. On it goes. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number, if you want to drop into our live chat room, go to tomhartmann.com and click live chat. It'll get you there. David in Bainbridge Island, Washington. Hey, David.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to, apropos your monoculture, several days ago in the Seattle Times, there's an article about Tom Monahan and a developer in Florida.
Tom Monahan, the founder of Domino's Pizza.
Yeah, they were going to...
And a major funder of anti-abortion efforts across this country over the last two decades.
And they were going to establish an all-Catholic community and university called Ave Maria. And they were going to restrict any birth control, any pornography, and that a town was going to be a place where children could play with safety in the streets. My question is, who's going to protect the children while they're in church?
From the Catholic priest. Yeah, it's sad that we have to be so cynical, David. It really is.
Yes.
But it's also somewhat bizarre. Well, actually, it's not, when you think about it. You know, I was going to say it's bizarre that somebody would propose to create a monoculture town, that is, a town that's all one religion. But the reality is that there's large chunks of Salt Lake City that are like that. The reality is that there is a human instinct to have tribe, family, clan, you know, to have that connection, to be with others like yourself. I mean, that's just a basic human instinct that we can't deny. What we've done in the United States successfully over the last 230 years, at least up until Lee Atwater started his politics of divide and conquer, you know, with Reagan and Bush Sr., up until then, what we had in this country was a relatively successful effort to bring people together and to respect each other's cultures. Actually, I shouldn't even say that, because for the first, you know, 100 years or so, well, even to this day, there's still a large racial divide in this country. We had slavery. So I think that sense of these are my people, this is my community, that's just a human nature thing. And what we need to do as Americans is, you know, what Franklin Roosevelt tried to do and did so successfully during World War II in particular, although nothing like a war to sharpen your wits, right, is to bring Americans together as Americans.
Well, may I comment on Monahan's anti-abortion stand? In the 2000 Republican convention, there was a delegate asked about the Republican platform concerning birth, and he said their platform is, we'll get you born. After that, you're on your own.
Yeah.
We have 500,000 children in foster home in this country, and I don't see anybody of the evangelical right stepping up to adopt them.
No, it's a terrible problem. I have a dear friend in Germany who is personally very opposed to abortion. And so what he did was he created an organization. They put posters up around Germany. This was back 20 years ago, in the late 70s, 25 years ago. Put up posters around Germany that said, if you're pregnant and you would consider carrying your baby to term, we will do everything to get that child adopted. We will even take custody of the child until it's adopted. We will pay for all the expenses of the delivery. We will pay for all the expenses of the adoption. And, you know, this was privately funded. This is what he did. Rather than going to the government and saying, we're going to go to women and say, we're going to put a gun in your face if you try and get an abortion, he was trying to, you know, offer an alternative. That seems to me like, you know, the reasonable path. But as you point out, David, the right-wingers who are all anti-abortion are not about to do something like that. That would just be too compassionate. David, thanks for the call. It's great to hear from you. I appreciate it. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary.
Hello, Senator Hartman. Oh, I'm sorry,
yeah.
Mr. Hartman.
No, never. I got a good gig here. I really love doing talk radio, and I really love writing books, and I think I do both of them fairly well, and I would be lousy as a senator.
I've thought about this, and I think you're making a good decision. Who am I to say you're making a good decision or a bad decision?
Thank you.
I understand your decision.
Yeah.
But anyway, I call a couple things, if I may. I don't know. I think Bill O'Reilly is a good person and a good man. I don't know if we should give up on him just yet, if you will.
I think he's clinically paranoid.
Let me bounce this off of you.
Sure.
I just don't think he doesn't understand the Franklin Delano Rosen vision and philosophy for America. You do, I do, but he doesn't.
Yeah.
I just think that you might be surprised down the road. He may come our way, surprisingly.
Gary, I guess the only response I have to that is...
Well, the shut-up line has happened only once in 6 years.
You want to know what I'm doing?
Shut up. Listen, cut his mic.
No,
35 minutes. Shut
up. It is our duty as loyal Americans to shut up and shut up publicly.
Do we expect every American to support our military, and if they can't do that, to shut up? So you keep your mouth shut.
Yeah, so there you go, Gary. Shut up!
I know he's got a short fuse, but so do I. So do a lot of us. Now, the second thing, if I may.
Okay. All right.
I want to ask this is what I wanted to ask you.
Here's the thing, Gary. I'll tell you what. You know, what we should be doing, I am half tempted to run a contest on this program, give away an autographed book or something to anybody who can successfully say Keith Olbermann on The Bill O'Reilly Show.
Oh, I love Keith Olbermann. I love him. He's a man. He's a real man. Tells it like it is.
Yeah.
To ask you, because the environment is a very big thing with you, and rightfully so. You have been a leader on that. Now, as you know, my political hero was Ed Muskie.
Mm-hmm.
Who currently in the Congress, or anybody that you know in the Congress, or who's going to run for office, could even begin to pick up the godfather of our air and water pollution laws?
I think Russ Feingold could. I think Barbara Boxer could. And never underestimate the ability of somebody to rise to the occasion. I mean, it might even be Hillary Clinton. Who knows? I don't know, but I do know that there are good politicians out there and there are statespeople. Gary, thanks a lot for the call.
I think
what politicians do is they look for a parade that's already going and they run out and get in front of it, and that's what's going on. Gary, thanks
for the call.
Orlando,
Florida, Mike, go.
Hey, Bill, I appreciate you taking my call.
Sure.
I like to listen to you during the day. I think Keith Olbermann showed.
There you go. Mike is he's a gone guy. You know, we have your phone numbers, by the way. So if you're listening, Mike, we have your phone number.
Oh, we do.
And we're going to turn it over to Fox Security.
And they're going to get you.
A little visit.
Yeah.
Maybe Mike is from the mothership.
No, maybe Mike's going to get in big trouble because we're not going to play around. When you call us, ladies and gentlemen, just so you know, we do have your phone number.
Don't you dare say Keith Olbermann.
And if you say anything untoward, obscene, or anything like that, Fox Security, then we'll contact your local authorities, and you will be held accountable. Fair?
That's fair.
So just all you guys who do this kind of a thing, you know, I know some shock jocks, whatever, you will be held accountable. Believe it. We'll be right back.
Yeah. Okay. So, Bill, if you want my phone number to put into your caller ID, it's 1-866-440-8466. Give me a call. We can talk about it. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. We'll be back in just a moment.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Don't bring me down. No, 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 no.
And welcome back, my friends. Ten minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Viagra for your brain. Some amazing stuff going out there. In fact, it's worthy of one of our Twilight Zone alerts. Yes. Very strange. Dozens of Central Texas drivers got pulled over Thursday for doing absolutely nothing wrong. In Travis County, deputies kicked off what has become a controversial reward program. Yes, they pull you over if they see you driving well. And they thank you. They also give you free baseball tickets. Yeah, some people think it's kind of cool. Driver Aaron Baker says, I was really surprised, but it's cool, though. I thought I was in trouble, so it was a little nerve-wracking. Yes. Could it be that they want to tell you that you're driving well, or could it be that, what's that you're smoking, sir? You know, are they looking for something? Who knows? I don't know. But apparently in Central Texas, they don't have to see a crime in order to pull you over. See, now this is really crossing the line, because my read of the law is that a police officer can't just randomly stop. Well, maybe they can. Actually, maybe they can, because they put up these roadblocks to look for, make sure that people have insurance in their cars and make sure that they have valid driver's licenses, and that has been tested before the Supreme Court. So maybe they can just stop anybody anytime they want. And it's like airport security. It's just get used to it. The cops are here all the time. Don't you know? It's a police state now. Speaking of which, here's another one, another Twilight Zone alert. This by Rick Popley in the Tribune, the Chicago Tribune. Auto dealers are going high-tech to ensure high-risk buyers don't default on their loans. This is this company called OnTime Systems. They put a microchip under your dashboard. They link it to the car starter. And if you don't make your car payments on time, it shuts off your car. It's incredible. This is... When Delilah Grant of Chicago's West Side went shopping for a car, she knew her recent bankruptcy would make dealers wary of lending her money. But as she shopped among the used car lots in North Cicero Avenue, she found a dealer that offered her a loan with one big catch. No dough, no go. A microchip in her car would disable the starter if she didn't make her payment on time. Remarkable. Sharon in Kimono Island, Washington. Hey, Sharon, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for educating us every day.
Well, I do my best.
Anyway, you asked earlier what is behind Tombo's bill to destroy the Endangered Species Act, and I think you cannot overlook the impact of the NRA lobby. I have in front of me an article written by one of their top legislative action guys for 10 years where he targets all the groups they are going after. And, of course, the Endangered Species Act is top on their list.
Really?
The Clean Air and National Environmental Policy Acts enacted in 1970, the Clean Water Marine Mammal, I'm reading his words, Marine Mammal Protection Act of 72, the Endangered Species Act of 73, the National Forest Management Act of 1976, and they go on, and of course, they are targeting every animal and environmental rights group from Doris Day Animal League to the Humane Society to the Rainforest Action Network, but, they are absolutely the strongest lobby next to probably the drug companies in Washington. On C-SPAN on January 6th, I watched their Institute for Legislative Action. I caught the tail end of one of their meetings, and a grassroots division leader, Glenn Caroline, was talking about the millions, the $23 million they spent on grassroots efforts in the 2000 elections, and that their goal is to get something they want into every legislation at state and federal levels. And they are working with small workshop groups everywhere in the country. They are lethal. They also said that they were the ones who defeated Tom Daschle and that they helped defeat Tom Foley years ago in Washington State. They're behind the FBI terrorist list, claiming animal activists and environmental groups as our biggest threats, terrorist threats. The NRA is behind a whole lot of this.
This is really interesting, Sharon. I'm a member of the NRA.
I know you are.
And I have never, ever been asked by the NRA about my opinions as a member. And I am, I joined largely out of curiosity.
I figured
it's not particularly expensive. And I wanted, I also send $5 a year to the Republican National Committee. And they send me all these offers of, I can have my picture
right.
taken with President Bush if I just give him $20,000 and stuff like that. It's interesting to be on all these different mailing lists.
Yeah.
And my sense of it is that the NRA is really a lobbying group
right.
For the big big gun manufacturers. You know, it's basically there's this industry of gun manufacturers that has a lobbying group. And I don't understand why a gun manufacturer's lobby group, which, you know, claims to be a grassroots organization and does have a lot of members, you know, and that does, you know, they do, I think. Yeah, and I think they do a decent job with, you know, like gun safety education. That's a good thing that they're doing. But I don't understand why they're going into all these areas that are so ideological, that have nothing to do with guns.
I know, but I think that they've tended to go very, very, very far to the, you know, it's our rights for everything, property management and whatever. And they've become so, you know, so right wing that there's just no coming back. But I would encourage you, I will email you the link to this article, and if you can, you know, look back through C-SPAN's videos and see if you can find, I mean, there's definitely their movement very, very strong against anything environmental.
Yeah, no, I know that they have taken these extremist right wing positions over the years.
A small group of people who were trying to limit some hunting because we've now, you know, got a big population here, and they organized and came in the hundreds from all over the state. They are very, very, very.
Now, see, that's the kind of area where, you know, I wouldn't be surprised that they did that. I wouldn't agree with it, but I wouldn't be surprised by it.
Right.
But you know, going after the Endangered Species Act, I mean, what, do you want to shoot bald eagles? I mean, this is supposed to be the lobby for gun owners and gun manufacturers. I don't get it. Sharon, thank you very much for the call and for, you know, sensitizing me and all our listeners to this. Coming up in the next Tom Hartman program, Bernie Sanders will be here on our Brunch with Bernie. Jeffrey Kleinman will be telling us about the latest DVD flicks, Be Here or Be Square, right here on the Tom Hartman radio program. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio. And remember, my friends, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.